Serious Eaters, you know how on CNN, MSNBC, Fox, they're always flashing that banner that says breaking news? Well, this is Ed Levine, and I'm waving the special sauce breaking news banner right now. So brace yourselves. Peter Regas, a pizza historian by night and practicing statistician by day, has uncovered definitive proof that the first pizzeria in America was not Lombardi's in New York City. That's right, all the dough that all of us pizza scribes have been slinging at you for the last 20 years, me, Adam Kuban, Scott Wiener, Evelyn Sloman, we've all got red sauce on our faces. To set us straight, Peter Regas himself is here in the studio, and as the news ripples across Gotham, New York Times restaurant critic Pete Wells will be joining the conversation, as well as Serious Eats culinary editor Sasha Marks. Enough stalling. A grudging welcome to the man who is making all of us look bad, Peter Regas.
Hello, Ed.
So do tell. I mean, because this was big news, right? To any of us who, I think my pizza book came out, 10 years ago or something? Scott Wiener's been researching pizza history for years now from Scott's Pizza Tours. Adam Kuban, who started Slice, the great pizza blog that became part of Serious Eats. I mean, we've all been putting forth a fiction.
Well, I think the story that I'm going to tell is probably more accurate than the story that was out before. I can say that.
That's such an impersonal way of dissing me. Very politic of you, Peter. But what was the first pizzeria in America, if it's not Lombardi's?
I know there's several more that were earlier than Lombardi's. That's the best information we have. There's an address in Brooklyn that I have, an actual ad. So it's hard evidence. We have a date on the newspaper. And that was at 42 Union Street.
In Red Hook.
Correct. And that was early 1898.
Wow. And then where did it go from there?
Well, just to back up a little bit, there probably were earlier ones than that, too. So as you go back in time, as you can imagine, the evidence gets a little bit murkier. But I've got one that I'm pretty sure about 1895 in 59 and a half Mulberry Street.
And what was that called?
What was it called? It was called, well, that's an interesting question. They actually probably did have the name because in the city directory, it said Pizzeria e Fornio.
Pizzeria e Fornio.
Right.
Fornio is oven.
Oven, exactly. So the speculation that that would be the city director canvas going up and down the block and writing who he thought the name of the proprietor was, but he actually wrote the name of the business. So it was a fortuitous error that
right.
he made.
That's funny. So that was in 1895, did you say?
1895. Correct.
Yeah. And then what happened?
Well, they destroyed that because they made that Mulberry Park or Columbus Park. And so that was torn down. There's not great documentation here. But what we know, there was a man named Filippo Maloney who had probably come, it's not clear, but he'd probably come around 1892 to America from Italy. He came from his home city was around the Sorrento city. And the first indication that we have hard evidence of him owning a business is at 47 Union Street, again in Red Hook. And we don't have good directories before then. We have some of the Brooklyn directories, but when the consolidation happened, they had really quality directories happen. And so that's the first indication that he's there. That would be then in the early part of 1898.
Okay.
Then what we have is that we have at Spring Street, 53 Spring Street, we have a permit that's applied for in the summer of 1898. That's for a bake oven. The man that appears the next cycle of the directory cycle, which would be the early part of 1899, is, depending upon the directory, is Phil Malone, Filippo Maloney. It's the same man.
Got
because
it.
We know his history now.
It's not anybody named Lombardi.
Not a named Lombardi, certainly not.
Okay.
And so what happens in the directories, if you look at enough of them, it's like different people looking at the elephant that are blind. So partly they describe it as a grocer. Some describe it as a bakery. But in the most rigorous directory that I know of, the Trois directory, they actually have it as a delicatessen, which is not obvious that you would see an Italian delicatessen at 1898.
This is on Spring Street.
This is 53 Spring Street is the address. So we know it was at the address and we know it's him. And then we know that when the census happens at the turn of the century, 1900, someone from their household describes him as a baker.
Okay.
This is all happening at the same time. An interesting event happens. He gets a flower salesman sort of tries to defraud him. And so there's a legal dispute that happens around June of 1900. This happened to a number of bakers at the time. The man was convicted and he went to Sing Sing. But shortly thereafter, Philip Maloney goes to different addresses. So the question is, what is he doing? Why does he constantly move during that period? So he's in Brooklyn in 1898 early. Then he goes to Spring Street. Then he goes to 130 West 26th Street for at least a year. Then he's coming back to 183 Mulberry Street.
So the only thing it has in common is that these are all Italian-American communities.
Yes. 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 The one at 130 West 26th Street is a little bit less. And so they call it actually, it's interesting, a French-Italian hotel restaurant.
Wow.
So that's got a lot of pieces to unpack
yeah, yeah.
because hotel and restaurant is
sure.
interesting. But he's back at 130 Mulberry. And the ad that we have that I publicized and found, there's an accompanying article with it that describes him as having a popular pizzeria such that he had to move because it was so popular. So he was at 183 Mulberry Street in early 1903. Then he apparently moves to 192 Grand Street because it's bigger and he's building out a little
right
bit more.
Right near are the second Serious Eats World headquarters at 197 Grand.
Right across the street from Ferrara. Exactly.
Yeah.
And from that period, he's there a few years, and we actually have a confirmed ad with his picture on it. And the interesting thing is when they first took out ads, very often there would be an accompanying blurb in the same paper, at the same edition of the paper. And in this blurb, they describe him as having specialties in Naples that the people around the community would recognize. And not just specialties, but specialties from Pizzeria Portalba, which is a famous pizzeria
yes,
in Naples.
Yes, which is still there.
So it's not exactly clear if they're boasting, if they're just using words cleverly, or if the situation is such that he actually was there. And if he actually was there, that's very exciting because Phil Maloney also is different from Lombardi and Pero in that he comes from an older generation. So he was born around 1862. We're trying to find the birth certificate now. But he comes from just a different generation. And if he would have come in 1892, he would have come around 30 years old. So he's mature in the industry. He's already established. Interesting enough, around that time, 1905, the Washington Post puts out an article, and the article is an Italian man who takes a American reporter, a woman, down to the Italian community. And he says, I'm going to show you these hotcakes, and they're pizzas, right? So he takes them to a pizzeria on Spring Street. We're not sure which one it is, but the description is almost exactly like the Lombardi, the picture in the interior. They describe the booth, they describe the long tables, they describe the benches. I'm virtually certain it's Lombardi's, the description. But the interesting point is that he makes is he says, of all the places that sell pizza here, two are by far the most authentic, and that is this one on Spring Street and the one on Grand Street, where at the time Maloney's at. So he would have opened up the two spots that were the most authentic.
But it also implies that there were more than just two pizzerias.
Exactly, exactly. So this gets into the issue of how do we define a pizzeria? There would have been, as Scott Wiener has said many times, if you were a Southern Italian with a bakery, with a dough, it would have been highly probable that it's, at least on some days you would have turned out some of the pizzas. And my perspective on this is that if you're making dough primarily to make pizza, that's a special category. That shows intention and commitment to the product and confidence in the product. The other bakeries who are making dough for bread, that is a trivial thing to just turn out a sheet of pizza dough, right? So it's interesting, and you can always say that there was pizza in America since the first Southern Italians were actually here. But we're talking about Philip Maloney and the group of men in his sort of cohort. They're doing something different. They're doing actual what is going to turn into, instead of grocery baker pizzerias, they're going to turn into actual dedicated pizzerias that we have ads for.
And so you're saying that Mr. Maloney probably opened Lombardi's.
What turned into
Lombardi's. What turned into Lombardi's. He opened John's.
What turned into John's on Sullivan Street at that
right.
time.
Right, and then they moved it to Bleecker Street.
Correct, eventually, right.
And that was John Sasso.
Right.
Who presumably learned his craft either from Mr. Malone or from somebody else.
Right, and the interesting thing about John Sasso is he married into the extended Philip Maloney family. So...
Wow,
so once you get into it's the details like... of it, the family relationship, in fact, that's an interesting point because all the early pizzeria men came from the Campania region that I found, except one, and that's John Sasso, and he married into the family.
That's awesome. So how did you come upon all this? I mean, Peter, it's one thing for Woodward and Bernstein to bust open Watergate. You're taking investigative reporting to a whole new level.
My sister says I'm obsessed.
A pizza obsessive, or are you just an obsessive?
Well, I like the food. Who doesn't? I traveled for business, and I went to the old communities. And what first this is right in the Jeff Verrazano pizzamaking.com
sure.
era.
Sure. Jeff Verrazano was the very famous blogger who did about a 10,000-word attempt to replicate the original Patsy's dough.
Right. And I saw that and I saw, well, that's curious. And so then I went to pizzamaking.com and I got into the Evelyn Sloman threads and she started talking about the history. And she got into rather heated debates from a baker in Naples about Lombardi and the way it started. And I saw that and I thought, first thing I saw was I thought there would be a survival bias so that the history that she was giving, and she did a great job on her book, but the history that she was giving had an enormous survival bias. So she was counting the people as significant if they survived as a business to the current day.
Got
that
it.
She could capture the story. The immediate question was there must have been a lot more at that time who didn't survive, who went back to Italy, who died out or whatever. So I looked at that and I said, well, that's a curious question. And then I saw some of the comments that were being made and I thought, it doesn't really ring true to me. There's something missing there, but I didn't really know.
Yeah, so, and for those people who don't know, Evelyn Sloman was actually one of the inspirations for my pizza book. She wrote a book called, I believe it was called The Pizza Book.
The Pizza Book, exactly, yeah. In 1984. And it's a great book, and she deserves all the credit in the world for being there at that time because she was the one that visited Jerry Pero and got a lot of the information that no one would have had. And there's a question whether serious New York-style pizza would have died out
right
at a certain point. So I saw that and was curious, but I didn't really want to start that. And then I started – there was a famous, at one point, very well-known pizzeria in Chicago called Great Lake.
Oh, yeah. I know that place. We had a Serious Eats party there.
Right. So I went to Great Lake one Saturday. This was probably in February of 2009.
It was a great Chicago pizzeria, not making Chicago-style pizza. It was really his own style of pizza. But the weird thing was there was only room for 18?
About 11? No, smaller than that. There was a long bench table and one small table.
And it was very weird and wonderful. Just wonderful husband and wife team.
It was very hardcore. If you're a pizza purist, that's your spot.
Yeah.
So we were at the bench table, and we got our pizza. And I noticed out of the corner of my eye, there was a man, an elderly man with glasses on, and with another younger woman. And that wouldn't have been surprising, but they had three pizzas between them. And he started eating the pizzas or the slices, and he would leave the crust or a large portion of them. And I thought, well, that's odd. He's not really eating like a normal person. And then I saw him take out a notebook and start writing in it. And that got my attention. And I said to myself, I'm going to introduce myself to him. And it turned out to be Alan Richman.
Alan Richman, who was the longtime restaurant critic for GQ, still writes for GQ.com and freelances for a lot of other people and is, you know, a great food writer. Probably won more James Beard Awards than any individual.
Well, at the time that he said his name, I didn't know who Alan Richman is because I was not.
You weren't a foodie.
I was not a foodie. Yes. Yeah. I told my friend that and he said, you idiot. It's Alan Richman. He's a big deal. Anyway, I talked to him about pizza. At this time, I'd been to the East Coast. And so he said, well, why don't you come on my next one? So we went to sort of a famous Chicago stuffed pizza place. And we both really didn't enjoy it. But he started asking questions and it was a questions that I didn't have answers to. And it was an interesting discussion. We had a good time, and that was that. But all these things sort of nudged me in a direction to sort of raise questions in my own mind. And what then happened is I went to an Italian deli in Chicago, and I was waiting for my sandwich to come, and they had one of those little free flyers I was reading from. And they had an article about deep dish history of Chicago and the fact that Chicago had a cultural historian that I had no idea we had. His name was Tim Samuelson. And when I read that, I was like, well, this is sort of the last straw. I have to go see this man. And I lived about four blocks away from him where he worked. And I waited for an hour for him to come down. And he finally did. We talked for about 3 hours. And he said, at the end of it, you should do a book. And I said, I don't have time to do a book. He said, do a book. And I said, well, I'll look into this whole thing. So I started to go to the Newberry Library, do the genealogy on Chicago. This is the point. On just Chicago. It's going to be a Chicago piece. Right. No big deal. Then about a year in or so, I started to get bored with looking through telephone directories and city directories of Chicago. And they had the New York directories there. And I said, you know, I've done all these things about Italians in Chicago. I should do the same thing about New York. I believe the story, you know, because everyone had it in their books, just like everyone else. But I thought, if I'm going to do it for Chicago, I better do the same application for everyone in the book. So,
especially because the New York pizza culture and the East Coast pizza culture preceded the Chicago pizza culture.
Yes, right. So I did it for Lombardi, and there's a general directory where you, I mean, it's perfectly easy to do it. Anyone could do it. It's on the microfilm, and you look under L's, and he's not in there, or a man of his description is not in there. I looked for Antonio Pero, couldn't find him. Antonio Pero was a worker, so I wouldn't have expected him to be in there. But Lombardi in 1905 or around 1905 should have been in there, looked under various spellings. He's not in there. That's strange. Then I picked up what they had. They had the 1910 business directory. And that was interesting to me because they have segmented. So the general directory is just by alphabetical order. Everyone's in there. The business directory has bakers as a group in alphabetical order, grocers, restaurateurs, everything, right, in separate sections.
Right.
So why not look at Lombardi and the bakers? Not in there. Look at the grocers. Not in there. Restaurateurs. Not in there. Well, this is getting really strange. It's 5 years after they claim to have the license. Plenty of time to put him in there. He should have been in there. Then as the last thing, I said to myself, this is really frustrating. I'm going to go through every one of those things and look at every one of those bakers because I'm going to look for 53 Spring Street to see if someone is in there. Maybe they misspelled the name or whatever. I'm going to look through every one of them. So I started on bakers, started at A, and I got to D, and I found a man by the name of Francisco DiRico at 53 and a half Spring Street under bakers. And within a second, I said, I have a major story here.
Wow, that is some Woodward and Bernstein stuff, man. That's, and you didn't even have a deep throat.
I would say a deep dish,
maybe
but
you
that's
do. Well,
no.
Deep,
I would say
that was just low-lying fruit, man. You can't say deep dish. I know that my friend Pete Wells of the Times was very, very excited, and he and I have been talking actually the last few months about pizza history, and he's been talking about, like, nobody's done a definitive history of the slice, and you've taken it one step further. So this is like, this is your life. Let's call him right now. Mr. Wells. Mr. Wells.
Okay, we got to talk about my technical difficulties.
Yeah.
So that was me holding the phone upside down. And you couldn't hear me.
All right. You're not going to believe it. First of all, I have in the studio Mr. Peter Rigas himself.
Ah, the troublemaker.
The troublemaker, the one who's making us all look bad. Okay?
Your whole career is based
My
upon
whole
a
career
lie
has
and...
been reduced to par-baked pizza dough. Peter, I should explain that Pete and I have been friends for a long time, and he was my editor at a couple of places, but he and I have been talking about this, as I told you, pizza. And also, when he heard about this, he had one of my favorite tweets. You know, the Twitter sphere was rocking with your revelations. And what was yours? What did you compared it to?
I said it was like if we found out that some other dude wrote the Federalist Papers and the Declaration of Independence and then, like, gave them to Madison and Jefferson. And we never knew it, you know. some guy named Tony all along.
That's so awesome. So Pete was very eloquent in his expression of surprise. And so I just figured he'd be a good person for us to talk to, you know, now that we've got you.
Absolutely.
Peter's been explaining his methodology, which is insane, which goes beyond Woodward and Bernstein.
Meetings in parking garages.
Yeah, he's not even meeting the
man.
He's looking for baker's licenses in phone books.
Follow the mozzarella, Peter.
So why don't you tell Pete very briefly so he can respond what you just told me?
Well, in 2009, I started on a pizza project for Chicago. And in about 2010, I stumbled upon a name that should not have been there in the New York directory under 53 and a half Spring Street. And that name was Francisco DiRico in 1910. And once I found that, I knew I had a major story in my hands.
And so then you moved backwards, though.
Once I saw that, I said, I'm checking everything and I'm spending every moment I can on this. For that first year, I was dedicated to that. And really, I mean, I got the story nailed down probably within the first 2 years of that. So by 2012, I had 90% of the story.
How did you know that was so significant?
Well, because I knew that the story being Evelyn Sloman's book and Ed's book should have been 1905. They've got the mercantile license. And by 1910, there's really no excuse not to be in the directory as a proprietor. So they had plenty of time to be in there or recheck the directory and put themselves in there. And once I saw that they were not in there, that was a major red flag to me. And so then I trained my eyes on Francisco DiRico. And within a week or so, I had found his descendants. And when I called one of them in Georgia, I talked to him and I said, I'm Peter Regas. I'm doing a book on the history of Italian bakers and grocers and restaurateurs. I think your grandfather might have been one. Is that true? And he goes, do you know where my grandfather had his bakery? And I said to him, I think I know where this is going. And this was Donnie DiRico in Georgia. And from that moment on, I went out to the DiRico family house and we talked extensively. They have photographs. What's interesting thing about the DiRico is that most of the people associated with that pizzeria, other than Lombardi's, never had children. So the DiRicos had 10 children. So then the question is, where were they? Why didn't they say anything? And apparently the family story was that the two elder daughters did write into the New York Times when they had a significant article about Lombardi's in the 50s, and they never heard back.
Yeah, Mr. Wells, that's your employer.
Okay,
we're talking about right there.
You know what? I've got that letter right here, and I just want to say I'm crafting my response while we speak. Because it is my job to answer every
query.
Disgruntled reader, yes.
So they never heard back from anyone at the Times.
That's the family story.
Right. Was Maloney's derived from that family?
No, there's no relation that we know of between Maloney and DiRico.
Got it. So, and then how did you happen upon Maloney then?
Maloney was a tougher case because the Maloney one first started when I started to look at the directory in the census. So if you do what's called an enumeration of the census, you look for addresses instead of the people's names. So it's a little bit more complicated and harder to do, but you find 53 Spring in the census.
All right. Wait, that's Enumeration of the Census, a very famous novel, right? No, that's in the realm of the census. I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
So I found Maloney. My memory is he was just right around the corner on Mulberry Street. But the significant thing is that I found him in the general directory as working at 53 Spring Street.
Got it.
As a baker. And that had my eyes wide open. He's a baker at 53 Spring Street around 1900. Great. Let's find him. So I did the genealogy on him. And I was let down because in 1905, he's in the state census, the New York State Census, as a pastry maker or a pastry baker. And I thought, well, I thought calzones or something. Or, I mean, I thought sfogliatelles or something, but I didn't want a pastry baker. So that was a big letdown. So I put him on the back burner for a while. And then I forget the reason why, but for a few months afterwards, I said, you know what, I better complete the story on him just to make sure. So I continued him on. And by the 1920 census, he was living at 175 Sullivan Street. And that might not mean anything to anyone else, but that was the bombshell because I knew from Evelyn Sloman's book that 175 Sullivan Street was the earliest pizzeria at John's.
You need to hire this dude, Peter.
I know, our pizza correspondent.
A combination pizza correspondent, investigative reporter.
Actually, I think that's a good idea. My idea is that some major university, like Hello New York University or Columbia, needs like an endowed pizza chair because there is so much work to be done. It sounds like Peter's doing a lot of it, but there's so much work to be done on the history of pizza in the United States. And forget about the Italian part of it, but, you know, this thing that becomes like, you know, like absolutely like universally recognized symbol of New York City, and we don't know where it started.
And Pete and I have been talking about this, Peter, for months now, because we did a sort of State of the Slice, which was an updated version on Sirius Eats. It was an updated version of a piece I'd written for The Times. And Pete and I started getting together at pizzerias, and he was musing about exactly what he just said. You know, like, why isn't there anyone who really is? So then I introduced him to Scott. And I thought, okay, you know, Pete, here, meet Scott Wiener. And he, you know, he was impressed.
Right. I mean, I think the lack of scholarship on the slice is even more inexcusable because it's so much more recent. And you're often talking about people, you know, in living memory who ran the first slice shops when the gas ovens came in.
There's so many people who could endow this chair that Pete's talking about.
Pizza should be appealing to some academically minded billionaire.
And an endowed chair, or maybe it should be a building on the new Columbia campus.
You know, they're even more ambitious than I am.
Yes, wow, like, you know, maybe we get Henry Kravis involved here, and you know, we can have a pizza lab. We get the physics department, the chemistry department.
It's just, you know, it needs to be sponsored because I don't. I mean, Peter, are you funding your research out of a book that you're writing? Like how are you able to do this work? Because I know this, the kind of stuff you're doing is incredibly time-consuming.
Well, I'm lucky enough to have a sister who lives in the city, and I have another cousin who's in Washington or around the Washington, D.C. area, so I have to go to the Library of Congress. I have a place to stay sometimes.
You have places to stay, right.
So that's enormously. Not... If I didn't have a sister in Manhattan, I would not have done this part of the project.
And Peter is a freelance statistician whose work takes him to New York a fair amount because you do a fair amount of work for financial institutions, right?
That's a little bit too gracious. I travel because sometimes I have to go out east, and I make an excuse to go to Brooklyn and New Haven or Trenton. That's the reality of the situation.
That's what I say to my wife. I say, it's right on the way.
Yeah, they always know what we mean when we say that.
It's true. That's code. We're
right
about
off 95.
Exactly. Pete, do you think what Peter's doing matters to how the pizza tastes now?
There are a lot of things I'd love to know that are probably unknowable, you know. But I'd love to know like things that nobody was writing down then, like what kind of tomatoes were they using? Imported cheese? Was somebody making mozzarella on Spring Street? Like, I'd love to know all this stuff. You know, the other like real missing link is the connection between New York and Naples. Like, you know, was our first pizza maker here like somebody who made pizza for a living in Naples, or was it just somebody who maybe hung out at his uncle's pizzeria and watched them do it a few times and thought,
right,
oh, I can probably do that?
What's interesting about that is Peter has traced at least one of these families back to Naples, to Port Alba.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a number of pizzeria makers, especially in the early period. One, they come from an older generation than Lombardi and Pero. So they're 1862 compared to 1887, 1881. So we're talking about older men. And we're talking about them coming as mature men, already established as bakers. Now, then the question, of course, is the great question is, were they in Naples or were they pizza makers in the province of the Naples or in the city of Naples? And there are very, very tantalizing hints that they may have been. I've got a few bakers on my radar screen that I'm still doing the research on. But if you had to hold, I think it's more probable than not they were pizza makers in Naples. Some of them probably were workers. I think a few were probably owners.
All right. Well, we have so many questions that we have to answer. Thank you so much, Mr. Wells, for coining the term follow the mozzarella.
Follow the mozzarella.
Hashtag follow the mozzarella. All right, Pete. Thanks a lot, man.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So now, Peter, we're going to bring in another guest, Serious Eats senior culinary editor, Sasha Marks, who is very opinionated and doesn't always agree with the Serious Eats overlord. And I wanted to get him in here. And one of the reasons he's really opinionated about pizza is that he spent some of his formative years, his high school years, in Rome. Did you not, Sasha Marks?
High school and childhood years. So we moved there when I was 5, and then I moved back to the States for college.
So that's a long time. It's like over 10 years.
A good amount of pizza eating time, yeah.
So what was your pizza introduction then in Rome? And what was your take on it?
So in Rome, there are sort of two main styles of pizza. There's pizza al taglio, which is the sort of equivalent of pizza by the slice, which is, you know, more of a grab-and-go kind of street food,
and
I guess.
Is that
you
where
would
they
say.
Cut it with the scissor?
Cut it with the scissors, and
it's oblong, right?
Usually it's baked in teglie, which are sort of large sort of black steel pans in a gas oven, and then you sort of pay. Why it's called al taglio, which is meaning sort of by the cut, is that you can define how big your slice is. It's sold by weight, and so you can get, you know, at the time, 1,000 liras worth of pizza, or, you know, 6,000 liras worth of pizza now by the euro, I guess. And so that
was one style.
One style, yep. And then there's also pizza tonda, which is more like a sit-down pizzeria, sort of getting an individual pie like you would at a Neapolitan pizzeria. But the Roman style, the crust is much different. It's a lot thinner, a lot more sort of cracker crisp, also baked in a wood oven, but doesn't have that sort of puffy rim or cornicione that you have on a Neapolitan pie. And, you know, it's sort of, that's sort of very casual eating in Rome.
It's funny because neither of those styles made it intact to the States, did it?
Not really. Although now you're starting to see it. I think it's sort of, you know, in the States with pizza, we're always sort of looking for the next, like, sort of niche market. So for, I would say, the early 2000s was the Neapolitan pizza boom.
Right, and then a couple of pizza by the foot places did open.
Right, and so now there are, you know, and then they got into sort of Roman, I should have said there's one more kind of style of bakery pizza. So earlier Peter had mentioned the forno, and it's talking about sort of the great pizza debate in the early 1900s in New York. And in Italy, a forno is a bakery, and a lot of bakeries have, you know, they'll do some styles of pizza. And in Rome, one of the most popular ones is what they call pizza bianca, which is basically just sort of kind of the idea of focaccia, like a pizza dough that's sort of dimpled with your hands, then sort of covered with a lot of olive oil, sea salt, sometimes rosemary, and baked directly on the deck of an oven.
And Jim Leahy learned how to make that in Rome.
Right, and then at the Sullivan Street Bakery. So that was, there's sort of that came to New York, and now you're sort of starting to see some more, like, you know,
Chefy pizza. Gabriele Bonci.
Gabriele Bonci has opened in Chicago, actually. And his pizza al taglio is amazing. Stefano Callegari has opened a couple of spots here in New York. He's a very sort of a great pizza al taglio pizzaiolo, but he also does sort of sit-down pizza in Rome as well. And then Danny Meyer opened Marta and Martina, which is trying to do more of that Roman style pizza tonda.
Thin crust.
Super thin crust, very crispy. So I feel like we're always trying to find the next pizza frontier in the States and something that, you know, not everyone is doing. I feel like we've sort of saturated the market on Neapolitan style pizzas in a way. I mean, you can never have too much great Neapolitan pizza, but I think that, you know, you're sort of seeing it now in New York, especially as State of the Slice sort of got into, you're getting this revival of New York style pizza.
It's fascinating that the evolution of pizza continues to this day because at its heart, let's face it, as people have said, including me, even bad pizza is pretty good. Number two, chefs have taken a liking to it. And Alice Waters once told me for my pizza book that cooking is easy, pizza is hard, you know, because there's nothing – when you're making pizza, as Sasha can attest, there's nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
You know, it's like every one of the three or four components has to be spot on.
Yeah. I totally said the happiest I've ever been as a professional cook was when I worked at a restaurant and worked the wood oven station making pizza. And it's sort of the – for me, it was the best experience of – it's completely tactile and then – you really, you control every aspect of the food from building a fire and managing a heat source to then making of dough and, you know, all of that. And then just sort of the repetition of it and the craft of it and sort of knowing, you know, most diners won't know like the day that you really nail every pizza.
Right.
But then like you and the people on your team in the kitchen or your chef, they're like, oh, man, today that pizza was on point.
Exactly. There's two stories I have about that. One is Chris Bianco, the famous pizzeria owner in Phoenix, once told me that I can teach a monkey how to make one great pizza. That the hard thing is making 100 great pizzas every day when all the conditions change.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no better feeling. I mean, because the first, like, months that you're, you know, working on a station like that, it's, you know, you're never doing it right. You're never doing it right. It's, you know, I think Daniel Boulud said that, like, praise in the kitchen is the absence of criticism. So, like, you're always hearing how badly you're doing, and then the day that you finally do all right, I think the chef told me that, like, oh, that one didn't suck. And so,
right. Yeah. So that's interesting. I think, Peter, you know, you're going to be studying this this podcast.
It's almost like we have a live laboratory now. And is there an analogy in the past that you can say, well, this is how the bakers move now? Would that have happened in the past? So I think, I mean, we have the benefit now of actually talking to bakers and seeing them operate, where we just have a paucity of information in the past. So we're just holding on to tiny threads to infer what actually happened, whereas now we actually have really good information. So maybe the present can tell us a little bit about the past.
Now, Sasha, Peter actually admitted he likes pizza. I don't know that he loves it with all his heart and soul, though.
Do you
love it with your heart and soul?
Maybe my heart, but not my soul. I don't know what that means, but it means something.
But yeah, I mean, I love pizza. I pre-gamed this podcast by getting a couple slices at Mama's 2, which you wrote about, which is not too far from here.
And close to his house.
My fiance and I heavily lobbied to have our wedding at a pizzeria here in New York. And
really?
Yeah, that one didn't work out so well.
It didn't fly with the in-laws?
It was, we wanted to have it at a spot in Bushwick that was a little too Bushwick,
oh,
I guess.
Oh, the one near Nikki's? What's the name of it?
At Roberta's.
Oh, at Roberta's, okay.
But so we compromised and we're having our rehearsal dinner the night before at a pizza place, a different pizza place. I think that, you know, I really can't go more than a week, maybe at max a week, without eating pizza. I mean, recently over the holidays, I spent a week in Paris, and I was going through withdrawal by the end of not having pasta or pizza.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
From JFK, we ordered pizza to make sure it was there when we got home. So.
I had no idea, Peter. I'm learning a lot about one of our employees now, which I love. Now, where did you make pizza? In Boston?
Actually, in Maine.
In Maine?
Yeah, working at a restaurant that we had, you know, farms where we grew ingredients and stuff. And then this
What was the name of the restaurant?
It's called Earth. I was working for Ken Oringer.
Ken Oringer is a very well-known Boston chef restaurateur that you spent many years working
for. Yeah. And then the two executive chefs who are now very close friends of mine, they had opened... they were on the opening team of Flour and Water in San Francisco, where they do amazing pizza. And so their pizza program was incredible.
Got it. We are going to keep going because I could talk about pizza for hours, but we're going to have to end the first special sauce pizza episode. I have to thank you, Peter Rigas, for setting me straight, teaching me the true lineage of pizza in the States. Rigas is writing a book on the history of pizza in America, and he's going to be giving a lecture at the U.S. Pizza Museum at the Roosevelt Collection in Chicago. So cool that there's a U.S. Pizza Museum. Peter, when is the lecture at the Pizza Museum?
It's February 23rd.
And tickets are free. You do need a ticket. You can get it online. And it even comes with the first 2 hours of free garage parking.
It should be fun.
Yeah. And Sasha Marks, Serious Eats Senior Culinary Editor, thank you for lending your expertise. And next week, we're going to have Kenji Lopez-Alt weighing in on pizza and everything that we've talked about here. But until then, thank you, gentlemen. Peter.
Thank you.
Peter Rigas, Sasha Marks.
Thanks so much.
And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.